I Hate Politics is a podcast about a human activity we love to hate. I'm Sunil Dasgupta. Maryland is up a creek fiscally and arguably without a paddle. The latest is that the state is in a $3 billion structural deficit. The cash deficit is smaller, a few hundred millions, but that may be even more serious because the shortfall has to be met now. The state has a rainy day fund it can raid, some monies it has committed to capital projects that it can claw back. But Governor Wes Moore is due his annual budget in a few weeks and has been telescoping difficult times ahead, particularly pushing back some of the requirements of the big education law called the Blueprint for Maryland's future. By 2026, the next gubernatorial election year, the cash deficit itself will be much higher. 2027 looks bleak. Unless something is done, revenue increase or deep spending cuts. But what can be done? With the State General Assembly about to begin next Tuesday, I asked two of the savviest House of Delegates Majority Leader David Moon and Chair of the Environment and Transportation Committee Mark Corman about what lies ahead. Stay with us.
I Hate Politics is brought to you by UMBC's Political Science Program, where you'll learn to shape public policy, impact communities, and function at the center of modern society. Learn more at shadygrove.umbc.edu.
I Hate Politics is a podcast about our neighborhoods, workplaces, schools and streets, and our local governments as they function in diverse and democratic societies. This means our politics are messy, dirty, sometimes corrupt, with often self-serving politicians. But no matter how much we may hate politics, we are never exempt from it, even when we refuse to participate. In fact, the purpose of politics is to keep society moving precisely when we don't agree with each other, like now. Music for this episode comes from the 1920s. Song recordings and films from a century ago just entered the public domain on January 1st. The song you're listening to now is As American as Mom and Apple Pie. Singing in the Rain first appeared in the Hollywood Review of 1929. Lyrics by Arthur Freed and music by Nacio Herb Brown. David Moon, Mark Corman, welcome to I Hate Politics.
Thanks for having us.
Hey, how's it going?
You are both in the thick of preparing for the 2025 General Assembly session. What is standing out to you? What should we be looking for? What are you looking for?
I'll defer to the majority leader to go first.
I think all Annapolis observers are keenly aware that the budget is going to dominate the coming legislative session. And if we're being a bit more specific about it, it's the $3 to $6 billion budget deficit we face in the coming years. And so I think you're going to see a lot of proposals for cuts to government spending, for increases to generate new revenues, and everything in between. And so I've been of the mind that we're in a real like civics 101 kind of legislative session coming up where, you find out what people really care about when money is tight.
And I would just add to that, you know, the $3 to $6 billion in future year projected ongoing deficits that David is describing is the quote unquote general fund, right? So education, public safety, healthcare. We have a whole nother separate funding crisis in our transportation trust fund that's not included in that number. Now, a hold harmless transportation budget will probably require us to find $400 to $450 million in revenue to actually do some of the big things we want to do. You know, the numbers only go up.
There's a deficit in the coming years, and that has to be dealt with. But the crunch is not really coming for another year, year and a half. Is that a good expectation to have? And I only ask this because that means that we are then into the 2026 election. How crunch is the crunch today?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's actually pretty significant today. I mean, there's, first of all, the budget is probably a few hundred million out of balance in the current fiscal year that we're in. But when you're looking at the fiscal year 26 budget, the budget we will be working on between January and April, that's about $3 billion out of whack. And that's a significant number. That's probably the largest number of the time, you know, David and I have been in office in terms of overlocked.
Folks are sensitive to the political risks and squeeze inherent in doing either cuts or raising revenues. And so, you know, it's often thought, well, you know, there's an election coming up. We gotta wait or think smaller on how we approach this. But there's always an election coming up every 2 years, and that was the logic for waiting last time around. And now people are waving the very next election coming up as additional reason to keep waiting. But as we do this, you know, the out year problem keeps growing bigger and bigger. So this is a real game of chicken here. You know, as to how much of the out-year deficits we're actually going to try and resolve.
I'm asking this mainly because the governor has shied away from speaking about this directly, about the revenue side directly. He has spoken about extending deadlines for the blueprint. He has spoken about certain things that can be fixed around the edges, but the bulk of it, he has hung his coat on the idea that the economy will grow. Where are you on that?
Well, look, let me pause here for a second and just, it's important to note that the blueprint is funded through the end of our term. And so really, when you're talking about, you know, blueprint cuts or delays, again, the blueprint is actually funded for the duration of our 4-year term. And so that's not to say out year deficits aren't very much related to the blueprint, but that's not what's in the immediate short-term future. So, you know, there are folks, Senate presidents, saying everything's on the table in terms of both cuts and revenue. I do believe the governor's in a very similar position, but they, you know, the governor floated some discussion about timing changes on some of the blueprint items. But again, I just point out this is in the context where, in the short run, it's other non-education items that are really jacking up costs. So I do think that probably ought to factor into where and when any savings or revenue adjustments come in for the shorter term deficit.
January 15th, the governor has to introduce his budget, and it has to be balanced. And so we'll get very clear insight then and there what the governor's position is, to your point about what he has and has not discussed. So that'll be, you know, a very important moment when we see how the governor wants to handle certainly the immediate problem, and then, you know, hopefully we'll start to wrap our heads around the medium and long term problem.
So the governor is doing his thinking, obviously, but what are you thinking about? Where do these adjustments lie from your point of view?
Last year, the House attempted to get ahead of this challenge, both from the transportation side and everything else, general fund side. And, you know, we passed a pretty big package. Frankly, some of it was pretty difficult. A lot of tough votes for people. I don't think anyone is excited, you know, except maybe a very few of our colleagues about, you know, raising taxes and fees, right? Raising revenue. Just as I don't think many of our colleagues are excited about, you know, massive cuts. But we put together a package that, you know, David, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was near $1 billion in ongoing revenue that would have generated for transportation and the general fund. And unfortunately, there just was not a lot of interest from our governing partners in taking much further action on that. We did ultimately do a few hundred million dollars in transportation only. So I think the House has kind of made the marker down pretty clear that we're ready to have the conversation. I can't speak for the entire House, obviously, but just based on the history, I think the House has made clear we're ready to have the conversation, but we also need our governing partners to participate in this process, right? I mean, it can't just be the House every year, you know, being the stewards of fiscal responsibility and these investments.
Well, that's the question, right? So given that the Senate was unwilling to play ball last year, are there changes to these the pattern of adjustments or your thoughts about adjustments now going forward, whether on the revenue side or on the spending side? What are you guys thinking?
Well, look, I think if you, again, just look at recent history and recent statements coming from the House and our governing partners, you do see some parameters of this debate. You know, last session and continuing onward, we heard language like the governor has a very high bar for new revenues. And again, since the out year projections continue to appear very, very challenging, in more recent years, we're hearing more of an open-mindedness. Again, the Senate president said everything's on the table in the coming session. And so I think we're obviously somewhere between there. Very high bar means you can expect some very lightweight attempt at doing revenues. On the much further end of it, you know, you're talking about a $6 billion problem. You know, we will see just exactly how many of these years of issues people are going to want to deal with in this immediate election year. I think this is one of the big variables. You know, everybody's at the table now, so I think that's a good thing, and the conversation is going to be had. But again, the bigger question outstanding is just how ambitious are we going to be in trying to tackle these longer term deficits this year. Of course, we have to have a balanced budget. So in the immediate future, something must be done. But again, the track record of it has been the House, as Chair Cormann noted, actually did propose a very, very specific revenue package. And when you look at what that package was, there was some combination of corporate loopholes, gaming, sin taxes. There were some vehicle fees, but it was a pretty concerted effort not to just shunt the entirety of the burden of either the cuts or the revenues onto one group, and certainly not on ordinary working Marylanders. And again, I think that's pretty well reflected in what we did last session. And so I think when you put it all together, there's clear parameters for a discussion there.
Is that what's coming back now?
I don't think we know yet. You know, folks have been working over the interim. We're having to factor in new information. If you were paying attention this past week to Congress, you know, depending on how the discussion on whether the government was going to shut down or not and what items would be included if the government didn't shut down, you know, Maryland probably had plus or minus a few hundred million, you know, hanging in the balance there. And so, you know, I think everybody is sort of wise to that giant X factor hanging, waiting in the wings for us. So I think we are probably due to be very cautious in our spending growth. We probably have to rely on minimal assumptions of additional federal aid, and certainly we're calling into question existing federal support. So we shall see.
I think a lot of the parameters of the discussion, Sunil, are going to be set by what the governor submits with his budget on January 15th. I think that's sort of going to be the first action that will start to, you know, shed a little light on what the, you know, rest of the 90-day session will look like.
Are the balances in the rainy day fund sufficient to cover the deficits right now?
It might be the case that if we entirely drained the rainy day fund, we would be able to cover the deficit, but we're not going to do that. I think the Spending Affordability Committee, I think they recommended we stay at 7.5% of the general fund. I think we're closer to 10 right now, so there could be a drawdown there. There are other, budgetary actions we can take that are, you know, maybe not that painful to people, right? Most normal people won't notice if we swap cash from prior sessions that we committed to capital projects that hasn't been spent yet and put that in the general obligation debt bucket instead, right? Most Marylanders are not going to notice if we remove a collar we call revenue volatility, which is a way we try to control for non-withholding income tax fluctuations. So there are things like that that we can do. I do not think that those alone can solve this for fiscal year 26, and they definitely cannot solve it in sort of fiscal years.
David, you mentioned the impact that the Trump administration can have on Maryland. Is there anything that the state can do? Are you thinking about state action if that were to happen?
There's two answers I could give to that. One is really about the highlighting the tight margins in the House. And again, we saw how there may be more opportunities for leverage and influence in the House, even though it's controlled by the Republicans, and we were still able to stick a landing on bridge funding. That leaves us to your earlier question about economic development. Much of it is this is stuff we would have had to do, whether it was Trump or Kamala Harris winning. We would have had to turn to economic development one way or another, in my opinion. And yet, you know, all the data points on worker shortages, housing shortages, and our tax base are sending enough warning signals that shoring up and broadening the state's tax base and economy seems very critical. And again, trying to get that into place, all the while we're expecting a shrink in federal spending, even more important. Now, the problem is, what can we do? And that is cost neutral, or that at least materializes in some direct line item where we can justify it. And so outside of, like, you know, the traditional tax credits or whatever, you'll see the governor talking about targeted deregulation, expediting of government permitting or licensing. And then on the other end of it, I would say you'll start to see things like housing production. I'll give you just one quick data point, too, from a recent talk with, teachers union officials, because I was just batting the concept of housing issues with them, sort of not their immediate thought process. But they did drop me one comment, which is that you've got something like 1,000 teachers in the Howard County school system live in Carroll County, but teach in Howard. And 2 teachers in the Carroll County system live in Howard and teach in Carroll, if you understand those dynamics. So teachers, by and large, cannot afford to live in the places they teach. And that's just the tip of the iceberg.
On the deregulation front, the main thing I've heard from the governor is about alcohol. Are you hearing other things about specific sectors of deregulation that he is targeting, or you think they ought to be targeted?
I mean, I will note the governor issued an executive order recently on sort of economic development, and it included, for example, a permitting council to try to help get permitting aligned better. And I think this is actually really important. We actually saw with the Purple Line, so actually a public project, the problems with the sort of government being misaligned on permitting, where the State Department of Transportation couldn't get their permits from the State Department of Environment. And so if the government is having trouble navigating the permitting alignment, I think it's, you know, probably 10 times worse for a private sector partner. And so I think, you know, you've seen him take some action in that area. And so that's one area where I think it kind of makes sense to, you know, maybe streamline some of these things, maybe reduce the number of site visits that are necessary on a permit, you know, try to have, a single form for multiple permits instead of multiple different forms. I will just say my own observation, for whatever it's worth, is that a big part of Maryland's challenge is reputational and attitude. What I mean by that is we have a bad reputation, and 8 years of being quote unquote open for business under the last governor did not change that. So even though a lot of the difficulties of doing business in Maryland are, you know, the same as in Northern Virginia, the view is that it's easy to do business in Northern Virginia. Whether that's true or not, it's a reputational challenge. And on the attitude, I would just say, and I think this is something we can all adjust for, that again, this is just my sense. If you are going to open a business in, let's say, Virginia, you are welcomed with open arms and they say, great, this form is already 2/3 filled out for you. And I'm going to walk you right down to the permitting office to get this done. If you go to open a business in Maryland, I think you get asked the question, why are you opening that business? What's your business model? Why do you want to do this? And it's just an attitude. It's this difference of the way people sort of culturally do business in Maryland versus other places. And I think that's something that, you know, the governor can really, I think, help to address by setting the right tone and hopefully seeing that trickle down into sort of the ranks of our Department of Commerce, into the different, State Department of Assessment and Taxation, all the different offices that a business that's trying to get started and grow would have to interact with.
On the housing production, have you actually seen an increase in housing production? Are we trended in the right direction? Because Wall Street Journal just did a story that said that all the rent control stuff is, in fact, making Maryland less attractive.
Yeah, I don't think we know for certain yet, but we are having a briefing early in January with the State Department of Housing and Community Development to sort of find out how progress is going with the new bills. Now, as you note, the legislation we passed last year could be working at cross currents with, you know, other changes being made at the local level. And, you know, even if what we did last year, you know, is working beautifully and is adding housing production, I think a lot of people still think there's more to do. I know there are many bills being introduced, including, I think, one by the governor to continue to sort of move in the you know, more housing direction. And so, you know, we'll get a better update at the start of the legislative session from the Department of Community Development. But even if they give us a glowing report about the success so far, I think we're going to see, you know, more legislation on this topic.
Yes. What should we expect from that legislation? Do you have a sense?
Well, for example, a task force was meeting over the interim about accessory dwelling units, ADUs. And, you know, as you know, in Montgomery County, we have ADUs by right. That is not true across most of the rest of the state. So one part of it is to, you know, sort of replicate Montgomery County in that regard. And then I think there's also a discussion about whether or not covenants that might exist that ban ADUs, right? So that's more of a private contract issue than a you know, government policy issue, whether those should be voided as well. I actually think Delegate Moon has a local bill on that, but I think there'll be a statewide bill based on the ADU task force. I think the governor has a bill on kind of almost like targets for housing production and what happens if certain targets aren't being met.
David, you follow the ADU situation in Montgomery County pretty closely. We haven't added that many. The problem is not that it's now allowed. It's just too expensive to build.
Let me clarify that a bit. It's people building with their own money for the most part. And so any unit that gets added to the state housing stock without state or local government putting a penny in hard dollars is a win, as far as I'm concerned. And when you have a county potentially that might be generating a few thousand housing units a year, if it's generating 100 or a few hundred ADUs in that period, that can actually end up yielding a significant percentage of the housing stock. And so I think at this point, from where I sit at least, I'm not speaking for the full House or Chair Corman here, It does seem like we want to keep encouraging as many different avenues as production. As with our state budget, I think we're not going to see any one source suddenly dump all the housing and all the types and all the income levels and all the locations that we need. It's going to have to be pieced together in all likelihood from various jurisdictions and various sources. But, and again, I'm really trying to pivot away from talking about this purely as housing stock, and really talking about the state of the economy and the state's population, with the sort of fairly level population we're seeing. If we had population decline or flat population growth in the last 3 years, and I think the most recent years' data shows an increase, but that's really from international immigration, and the net domestic inflows are still minus almost 20,000 residents from that last year. So, again, if you're us and you're policymakers, and you got to think about how to shore up the state's tax base in a longer horizon to deal with some of these out-year issues. You don't have much money to play with. Adding workers and residents who are adding to our tax base and economy seems like a good move. And when you look at other growing economies in other places, Texas, Florida, and like, housing growth has been one of the key things that preceded the economic growth. And it seems hard to get away from that reality when you have so many worker shortages across government and private industry in our area, and widespread sounding boards from the public that housing cost is at the front of all of this.
Well, you're right, except I want to know how. How do you energize the market to really start to build? Because that's really the solution. You can have a few hundred ADUs, but if you want tens of thousands of units, that's a difference in scale that you have to use the market.
If you go statewide with ADUs, are you talking hundreds or thousands? You might be talking thousands. You do some transit-oriented development, as with what was in the governor's zoning bill in the last year. And, knock on wood, I don't know what that's going to generate, but hopefully it's in the hundreds. Again, it's got to be accumulation of all of these different housing types. I don't think you're going to see a policy where one thing, again, generates all of the yield that you need. We've got to be pushing on various different fronts to keep these numbers moving in the right direction. But again, just to show you a couple case studies where real live public policy intersects with this, you had Jake Day in Salisbury trying to encourage shovels into the ground with expediting the process. And he seems to have had some success in that. And way back when, and this is obviously much more controversial, but I remember Blaine Young in Frederick County, again, sort of preceding the Frederick boom, when Frederick was a county commissioner's place and not a charter county, he was leading the charge on subdivision of rural land in Frederick County. Again, this was way before the Frederick boom. And so we see these live examples and these live discussions, both in our own state and outside of the state, for how you really can draw a straight line from policy reform to housing units coming online.
So I can't believe that I just heard Delegate Moon praising Blaine Young, but setting that aside, there is a ton of opportunity, I think, around transit-oriented development. And I think, obviously, we had a little focus of that in our legislative session last year with the governor's bill, which focused around rail stations. But if you look around the state, there's many opportunities around a lot of stations in Prince George's County, some of the further out stations in Montgomery County, and lots of stuff in the Baltimore area that has almost no development over their subway. And, not everything is going to be the size of a downtown Bethesda or a downtown Silver Spring, but, you can see some of the opportunity there when you have, almost, they're not greenfields because they're parking lots, but, you have almost greenfield-like opportunities around some of these stations.
Okay, so hopefully the economy takes off, hopefully housing takes off, but if you are going to cut, are there places that, in your mind, that are rife?
Yeah, I'm not going to commit to specific cuts on your podcast, Sunil, as much as I enjoy listening to it. I think, as David said, there is a high bar, I think, in the House to some of the changes to the blueprint that are being discussed, so we'll have to see what specifically is being offered there. But, we actually modify government programs basically every year. Basically every year we have budget cuts that we do. This will obviously be at a different scale given the size of the problem, but we have made many adjustments over the 11 years David and I have been doing this. Last year we made a change to community college fund. Tough to do. We like our community colleges. I know we also like USG with the two of you, but we like our community colleges. But it made sense to make an adjustment to how we were calculating a certain kind of aid formula. So we do a lot of that stuff every year. And so, yeah, we're going to have to bring all the folks in the legislature together to have conversations around a range of programs. But again, as the Republican leader, Steve Hershey, said, we are not going to get out of this just by draconian budget cuts.
I was reading the pre-filed bills list, and there's a bill that seeks to create different classes for property tax purposes. What do you think about that?
I think that can be part of the conversation. Personally, I think, you know, charging differential property tax rates is something done in lots of other places. And so I think that could be an opportunity here. I also think it's not just doing it based on the use of the property, but you could also see on the transportation side saying, hey, one of the ways we're going to fund transportation is through a higher property tax around transit station, because there's a value that you get there and an economic benefit. And so we can charge a little bit more there. We've also seen the concept discussed. I'm not sure one of the pre-filed bills, but I know someone will have this legislation coming of charging a different rate, whether or not the property is developed or not, to basically encourage people to actually use the property and not just sit on it, right? And that will also help with the housing discussion. So lots of opportunity there.
David?
This is one of many types of tax proposals being brought by various players this session. Montgomery County, Anne Arundel, and any number of counties had different versions of how to split the baby with property taxes that they have attempted. The Municipal League, which represents many of the cities' desires in the coming session, has their own tax proposal that when you boil it down, is basically going to apply to restaurants and bar sales within city limits. And you've got any number of additional other tax and revenue proposals that my colleagues are going to put on the table. So how it all shakes out, again, I don't know, but we're sandwiched somewhere between trying not to impact ordinary folks and working families, try not to worsen our worker shortage or flight in any way, try not to increase housing costs on those who can't afford it. And so our movement is quite constrained and our options are limited when you put them all together. So I don't know how it will shake out. But again, the county's pitching differential property tax is coming on a stack of other novel ideas. So at this point, I say bring all the ideas on. You know, let's actually hear them out, have bill hearings, and figure out what people are willing to tolerate. But again, it's hard for me to make a prediction now as to whether one particular model it should move forward or not. I'm frankly actually being very, very, very agnostic as to the form of revenues at the moment. And I'm just hoping all the players are sort of on board to do this in a responsible manner.
The one silver lining, if any, is that county revenues are in a better place than they were maybe 2 years ago. Are you looking at county revenues meeting some of these gaps?
I have not heard of any sort of specific, you know, item being offered here. And again, you know, I think the governor has to introduce a balanced budget on January 15th. So we'll see if he includes any proposals like that in his.
Any thoughts on how to fix the declining gas tax revenue issue that obviously the commission was not able to do anything about?
Sure. So, the commission did not meet this interim. There was a sort of blue ribbon commission, for the benefit of your listeners, that was set up 2 years ago. It met last interim and did come up with some recommendations, some of which we've enacted. Some of that was included in the few $100 million package from last year. And, you know, that I should say about that package from last year, that has been successful. So highway user revenue, which is the local share of transportation revenue, and local operating transit systems, the LOTS program, so LOTS and HUR. These are two programs that were on the chopping block last year and are not this year because the House, eventually the Senate and the governor, took action last year to get ahead of those. But yes, the commission did not meet during the interim, but just like the general fund side, as David was describing, I think you'll see a group of proposals, in once again suggesting possible ways to raise more transportation revenue. And one of the pre-filed bills, for example, relates to the state excise tax on vehicles. I think there'll be other ideas like that. And I also think the governor will come in with some suggestions of his own on transportation, because he, I think, recognizes the link between this infrastructure spending and the economic development goals that he has.
David, let me ask you this question. I think maybe and perhaps end with that. Working with the Senate is probably one of the hardest things to do, just because chambers are different. They have different cultures, and they have been reticent on new revenue. You have been very clear for a long time now that you would like to see new revenues. How do you square that circle?
I mean, I think in many ways, though we delegates face the voters for our policy outreach, most of the time, our senators often become one of the audiences for our outreach in these kinds of tough budget negotiations. But I think at the end of the day, everybody is trying to do what they think is right. My hope is that this lands us, honestly, in a productive, positive dialogue. I, for one, am looking forward to it. The governor and the Senate president are setting the table right now for a real discussion. I'm not going to prejudge where things are or assume that, we're sort of on our own at this stage of the game. Other than to say, I'll circle back to where Chair Cormann started. The governor is going to have the first crack with the release of the budget, but he and the Senate will be able to do this with the backdrop of the hard work the House put in last year, showing where our votes were on any range of options for revenue. So I do think we at least set up a few items for discussion in the possible budget debate.
Mark Cormann, David Moon, thank you for taking the time. I hope we can find you during the session.
That was great. Thanks, Sunil.
Thank you so much.
What lessons should we draw from my conversation with Maryland House Majority Leader David Moon and Environment and Transportation Committee Chair Mark Cormann? Well, first, now you know what the 2025 Maryland General Assembly session is going to look like. It'll be about the budget, money, and finances. Second, we are in a holding pattern for the governor's budget proposal. We'll be following, of course, but if you have thoughts on what's coming, talk back to us with a voice letter. Record on your phone and email the file to producer@ihppod.org. That's all for this episode of I Hate Politics, where we aim to stem the decline in local news by working with community voices. Don't forget to tune in to our Tuesday morning news analysis. I Hate Politics is produced by me, Sunil Dasgupta, with support from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I direct UMBC's political science program at the universities at Shady Grove in Montgomery County, where, among other things, we explore and learn about politics, government, and society close to home. Music for this episode comes from a century ago. This is George Gershwin's famous composition, Rhapsody in Blue, which started a new, more refined era in American jazz. Rhapsody in Blue is a staple in concert halls today and was commissioned by the 1920s star bandleader Paul Whiteman and premiered in New York on February 12, 1924. Usually we feature local music on the show. If you want to share your music or know someone else who might want to, please email us at producer@ihppod.org. I hope you'll subscribe and share the podcast as we bring you stories about politics close to you and to your home. See you next time. Happy New Year!